Thank you, Dr. Maurer, and I want to join the chorus thanking the NFB for sponsoring this event and for thanking Luann for all of her efforts at putting this together. I can tell you, as someone that studies law and social movements, what's happening here is unique. What's happening here is an important movement moment. What's happening here, these conversations are necessary. Part of it's happening in this room, but part of it's also happening in the hallways. So this conference is a huge and important part of where we are as an advocacy community, and it's just so wonderful that we're able to do this year in and year out. So, as many of you know, Passover is coming up next week, and I'll be celebrating Passover. I have a large family, which means I'm still at the kids' table. I'm 41 years old, I'm still at the kids' table, which is okay, because it's generally more fun there. But this year, I feel like that's okay, it's not a slight, because at this conference, on this panel, I get to sit with the grown-ups, right? This is a huge honor for me to share the podium, both this panel and last panel, with such leaders of the disability rights movement, people who I have admired throughout my professional career, people who I have learned so much from. So thank you for the opportunity to be a part of this conversation. I also want to note that one needs to be humble, have some humility in going last. There is a huge challenge to say something new after 2 days of really stimulating and thoughtful conversation. I realize also I'm the last thing standing between you and getting to leave or eat lunch, so I'll try to honor that responsibility. The role of the future is tricky, right? We've been asked to think about the future in this panel. And that's a hard thing to do. We need to, you know, Bob went to music. I'm going to go to sports for my thinking about the future. And there are two ways to think about this. One is, many of you know Wayne Gretzky. Wayne Gretzky was perhaps the greatest hockey player of all time. And when he was asked, what made you so good? He would say, I don't go where the puck is. I think about where the puck's going to be, and I go there. So to the extent you can think about the future and get there ahead of time, there are obviously huge rewards. Contrast that with the other great legal philosopher, Yogi Berra, who said, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. So hard to do. That'll let that sink in for a second. And I want to, as I'm doing this, reflect on my own position. So the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed before I went to law school. For all intents and purposes, I've never known a world without it. And I think it's important for all of us to acknowledge that in doing the work that we all do, we truly stand on the shoulders of giants who went before us as we think about moving ahead. These types of conversations make me think about my grandfather, my late grandfather, who was an immigrant to this country. Like many others, he came to this country fleeing religious persecution. He loved this country, but it never really entered his consciousness to object too hard to things like Jewish quotas, because he was just so happy that no one wanted to kill him for being Jewish. He thought that was really the most amazing thing on the planet. My generation, the ones that came after, had the luxury of being greedy and continuing to fight for equality. So too, it's like that with disability rights. In the next 25 years, we all have the real honor and the benefit of thinking aggressively about notions of disability equality, imagining what a better future will look like. And I talk about this from the vantage point of someone who has the privilege and honor of teaching the next generation of advocates in this area. And it's been so gratifying to see so many of them here this weekend. As you all know, they're coming. They are coming. Some of them are law students with disabilities. Some of them are law students without disabilities. But they are coming. They want to lend their talent, their idealism, their passion, their energy to this movement. They are going to learn from us, but they're also going to challenge us. Things that we have grown to accept drive them crazy, and they're willing to fight for. I had an interesting conversation last week with my class. We're covering Title III of the ADA, and we get to the whole, is the internet a place of public accommodation? It's not just that they don't agree that the internet is not a place. They can't even understand a world where the internet is not a place. These are students who do their shopping online, who see movies online. The whole concept of bricks and mortar is dated to them. Of course the internet is a place. It's where they spend a lot of their time. So they're different. So in this talk, I want to talk about several things. And it's not like they're unique to me or I'm even the first one to say them even this weekend, But I do think they are important. And then I want to offer some ideas toward not immediate change, but long-term change, taking that 25-year view. So I want to start off with a series, could really continue a series of uncomfortable conversations that we've begun this weekend. And one thing I know about Dr. Tenbrook from my study of him is he never shied away from talking about uncomfortable topics. And the first topic that others have addressed is most people don't think about the disability rights movement the way that we do. They don't think about disability rights the way we do. They don't think about it, as Dan suggested, as a civil rights movement. Most of them don't think about it at all. When the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, according to the Harris poll, only 18% of Americans were aware of it. 18%. That is very, very, very different than other civil rights movements, as Dan mentioned, despite the fact that disability is the one minority group we can all join at any time. We see that with the Sheehan case, right? Everyone's heard of Eric Garner. Everyone's heard of Michael Brown. We're talking about them. But who has heard of Gilberto Powell, Laval Hall, and Jason Harrison outside of this room? The country is currently engaged in a painful discussion about race and policing. Now, maybe nothing will happen as a result of that, but at least we're talking about it. And I think we have to acknowledge that there's no parallel conversation going on about disability. If we walked out on the street in any direction and asked who Teresa Sheehan was, nobody would know. Now, this lower salience, lower political salience, that disability is less of something that people vote on, are invested in every waking moment, in some ways that's been a real strength of our movement. It has enabled us to get a lot of these laws passed. But it also has costs. And in thinking about the 25-year plan, we simply need to find ways to get more people to care about the issues that we care about and get them to think about them in the way we think about them. And related to how people think is the fact that judges don't see disability rights the way we do. Because it turns out that all judges are people. And, you know, we have a federal judiciary problem. Several years ago, I was fortunate enough to do a training for federal magistrate judges on the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act. They do 2 a year, so it was half of the magistrate judges in the country. And huge room. It became clear to me within about 30 seconds, both from their body reactions and then the way they kind of cornered me after giving my talk, they hated this law. They do not see the law as a civil rights statute the way that we see the law. They see it as some annoying thing that now is begrudgingly going to apply to a larger universe of people. And the questions and the comments I got were, so I've got a cousin who's got a backache, now he needs to get this, and so on and so forth. They don't think about it the way that we think about it. We saw that in Justice Alito's comments in the Sheehan case, that, gosh, I don't, maybe, do we need to do reasonable accommodation under Title II? You know, yeah, we do. We all know that. But that is the background assumption that many people have of not thinking about disability as a civil rights issue. What I have argued contributes to that is, as been mentioned before, the state of constitutional law. Constitutional law is the highest law of the land, and it is still really, really bad on disability. Others talked about the Cleburne case and what that has to say. I wish Cleburne and disability cases stood for rational basis scrutiny with teeth. I've looked at it. Other groups have leveraged Cleburne in positive directions, the gay rights movement. In disability, Cleburne is always Cleburne equals rational basis equals plaintiff with disability loses. This is despite the fact that Justice Marshall, in his concurrence in Cleburne, was right. He was right. Cleburne's wrong. And this still has long-term effects. It limits what the ADA can do, and it's just wrong. So what can we do on these really hard issues? So look, I've got no easy answers. I just want to raise the issues, but I do want to offer up some suggestions on some longer-term strategies for us to keep our eye on. And the idea is to balance the need to continue enforcing the laws that we have, that very hard work that all of you are engaged on a day-to-day basis, but also continuing to think about how the law is perceived by people outside of this room. There are state laws that still discriminate expressly on their face against individuals with disabilities, usually individuals with intellectual or psychosocial disabilities. These laws are rampant in family law, in voting, amongst other areas. My home state of California has a statute that requires reunification services for parents and children, but denies them to parents with mental disabilities. Based on these discriminatory laws, as we know, parents with disabilities face state proceedings to remove children from their care, all too often. The Kentucky Constitution still has a provision that bars idiots and insane persons from voting. So I think in targeting these laws, because these laws are still on the books, and I think they present a clear target that we can and should challenge, when we can, we should focus on state constitutions to challenge these laws. Because sometimes state constitutions are more fertile grounds to bring challenges on. Connecticut, for example, has a state constitution that provides that no person shall be denied the equal protection of the law, nor be subjected to segregation or discrimination in the exercise or enjoyment of his or her civil or political rights because of, in addition to the normal laundry list of categories, including physical or mental disability in their constitutions. So here I think we need to look to our friends in the gay rights community who have been successful over time in using state constitutional litigation to move the needle on the federal constitution in terms of what is possible. Again, this is a 25-year plan, not a 5-year plan, but I think as a community we need to make some investments in that strategy. The Constitution may not give us everything that the ADA does, but I do think it's important to, over time, change constitutional understandings as they relate to disability, taking those gains on the state level and moving them to the federal level. For my students, and for me, it's simply unacceptable that the highest law of our land, which is our highest aspiration of who we want to be as a people, is so bad in our area. And that needs to be on our 25-year list of things to do. Now, when we talk about constitutional litigation, for doctrinal reasons that I won't bore you with, we need to acknowledge that that is not going to work for everyone that's covered by the ADA. It's simply not going to. Some people who are covered by the ADA realistically have no claim for any type of heightened scrutiny, even under more liberal state laws. And this relates to a conversation that we had in the last panel related to internet accessibility about cross-disability advocacy. I want to submit the fact that constitutional litigation may work better for some groups than others. That's okay. There are absolutely moments for cross-disability advocacy, and this conference is a wonderful example of cross-disability advocacy. But we're at a point in the movement where we're unified enough to acknowledge difference and to face up to the fact that the ADA has worked better for some groups than for others. So all movements, when you study law and social movements, they've all gone through this moment. So I think it's okay to acknowledge that we can have cross-disability advocacy, but also at times still pursue individual results and strategies. Related to this, I think when talking about the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the IDEA, or I forget what it's renamed in Bob's world, we need to constantly remember, and not just pay lip service to, but remember and push the idea that IDEA has its roots in Brown versus Board of Education. There is an argument that IDEA is constitutionally required. And we need to remember that that is what is behind that law. In terms of thinking about ways to get people outside this room to think about the issues that we do and care about them in the way that we do, certainly we want to continue doing what many advocates here have been so brilliant at, finding cases that capture the imagination of people outside the movement. Family law presents a fertile ground for that. The recent Sheltered Workshops case, judging by media coverage, is something that people can relate to. I want to suggest something that I'm not the first person to come up with, employment testing. And it doesn't even need to be brought in a legal sense. We all know that someone who uses a chair goes in, interviews for a job, they leave, someone without a chair, interviews, same qualifications. Who's likely to get that job? Maybe the person without the chair. I showed a video in my civil rights class, and this was from like the late 80s in St. Louis, and it was a housing case, and it wasn't even a lawsuit, it was like a 2020 expose, where a black person went in to rent an apartment, you know, okay, thank you very much, white person goes in, oh yeah, of course, get the apartment, and they caught it all on undercover cameras. Boy, is that powerful. You're able to capture something that we all know happens and project that to people to remind them, to put that in their face, that that is happening. That is something that can capture the imagination and ignite the imagination of people outside the movement. Two more points. CRPD, which has come up, the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. I strongly believe that we should continue to push for ratification. I think it's the right thing for the United States to do. It's the right thing for the world. But we need to be very careful that ratification is not the end game in and of itself. The way ratification is being pushed politically is what we are doing is just exporting our laws and our rights and our values to the rest of the world. And if that helps us get it passed, great. But if it ends there, it's a huge missed opportunity. We need to continue to find ways to do what other countries are doing, which is to use the CRPD as a moment to reflect on our own laws and think about ways that we can improve our what we do here and look for pressure points to pressure our government to do that. So I reject the notion that we have nothing to learn from the rest of the world. The last point I want to make comes back to students, because ours is such a unique movement. It's at a great moment in time where people like Arlene, you know, you have Arlene Mayerson and law students in the same room. Like, that is unique in terms of a movement. I think we have the ability and the obligation that the next 25 years of law students needs to learn from the people who came before them. I think that we're kind of at a neat moment where that can happen. One thing that I'd like to do to help that along, and there are ways now through technology to reach the students where they are. So I'll be reaching out to many of you. I want to create a podcast series intended for law students who are taking disability courses. And I want to talk to you about what you've done in the movement, why you've done it, what you think the next 25 years to be. And we as law teachers can have our law students listen to these podcasts, learn from you because they want to. Believe me, they want to. So with that, I want to thank you all very much. Again, thanks to the conference organizers, and thanks.